I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And we have the podcast Office Ladies. Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories and lots of laughs.
Follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, at your service. Welcome to the St. Louis Composting Garden Hotline with Mike Miller on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Good morning, and we are here to welcome Chuck Caverly to Studio B, downtown KMOX, the Voice of St. Louis, the Garden Hotline on a Saturday morning. The Garden Hotline number is 314-436-7900. There is also an 800 number. Don't forget to dial the 1-800-925-1120. Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
Good. So we're into June now.
We're into June. It's the summer season.
I can't tell you, this weather is unbelievable.
It's Chamber of Commerce weather, right?
Good grief. 75 on Monday?
It's what you tell everybody that lives outside of St. Louis, why we're such a great place.
Yeah, but this is rare.
It's fantastic. Well, wait 24 hours, it'll change.
Yeah, right, I know. Well, Wednesday, 88. So we're definitely going to go back up. But for now, enjoy every minute of it.
Oh, it's been a great, cool, wet spring. So we've got, it seems like, you know, a year ago it rained in April and we never got rain again until end of July. And then we didn't get rain until October. This year it's been every 3 days, every 4 days. So if you work outside like I do and trying to get production done, it's maddening, right?
Yeah. So have we got too much rain?
That's such a hard call. So if you, if you're grading ground and you need the conditions to be dry, it's kind of hard to get work done. If you're trying to plow a field and get your beans or your corn in, you know, June 1st is a magic day. So there's a lot of fields. I just drove down to Memphis a couple of weeks ago, drove out to Leavenworth last weekend, and there's plenty of fields across Missouri and southern Illinois that still are unplowed because they're just too wet. So, but the reality is all of this weather, all of this rain, I was thinking this morning as I was looking out in the backyard, the number of shades of green are just too many to count. There's so much happening, and if you've got variegated plant material and different textures in your yard and you're looking out that window right now, it's green, baby. It is green everywhere. So it's fun. It's a great time.
It's verdant.
It is happening.
You know where I'm going to go today is the Soulard Farmers Market work. Because it is that time. Yeah. Tomatoes are my joy. I love to make a cucumber tomato onion salad with fresh tomatoes. There's nothing like fresh tomatoes.
There you go. And there's nothing. We had friends over. My brother was in town from Colorado over this past week. And so Thursday night I pulled a turnip out of the ground. My wife picked our only head of cabbage for the first time ever, and we made fresh coleslaw with turnips and cabbage, and oh, man, was it good. Fantastic. That and the St. Louis pork steak off the barbecue smoker.
I'm bragging, but
man, it was fantastic. It was great. Nothing like fresh produce. And when you pick that stuff out of your garden and you bring it inside, those first 12 hours, 24 hours, the nutrient level of those vegetables and those fruits are their very highest. And so within 24 hours, the amount of nutritional value that they lose is incredible. And we're happy. You know, we go to the store and our shopping centers, you know, the Schnucks and Deerbergs and everybody else has all these great fresh vegetables. But they're nothing like coming out of your garden. You know, my wife grows those sweet 100 cherry tomatoes, you know, little cocktail tomatoes. And I swear to God, there's never a red one in our refrigerator. Because they never make it out of the garden. She sits and weeds and eats and weeds and eats those tomatoes. They never make it in.
That's funny. Yeah, I mean, there is just no comparison between grocery store, let's say, tomatoes and farm tomatoes or garden tomatoes. The taste is just so different.
And they're so easy, right? If you're in an apartment, if you're on a 5,000 square lot, if you're on a 5-acre lot, it's easy to grow tomatoes. They are just elementary. They're so much fun. And they're so rewarding. BLTs. We're big BLT fans, mm-hmm. and I think we forget about the lettuce. We're just happy with tomatoes and bacon, right? A little bit of Miracle Whip.
Yeah. Well, and, I just like to slice them up and eat them raw, just have a little salt and pepper on.
Yep. Oh, you're one of those guys, salt and pepper guys.
I could eat a whole, I could eat like a bushel of tomatoes.
Are you a salt and pepper guy on your melons, on your watermelon or cantaloupe?
Just salt. Melons.
Yeah, my grandfather, he used to put salt and pepper on everything, and I was just like, why are you doing that? The honeydew melon was fabulous, right? The cantaloupe was they're all good. For me, they're all good just the way they are.
So. All right, let's go to the phones. 314-436-7900. Chuck Caverly is taking your questions this morning. We're going to start with Gene. Good morning, Gene. You're on Garden Hotline.
Yes, I'm the lady that called last week about the cherry tomato plant on my deck in a container. And at that time, it only had one bunch of flowers, and I was wondering if I had to do anything to it. And the gentleman said, no, leave it alone. In 1 week, I have 11 bunches of flowers.
How about that? You're calling to brag this morning, aren't you, Gene?
They were right, and I am looking out at my yard, and it is gorgeous, just gorgeous.
Yeah, it's a fantastic time to be a gardener on the beginning of June in St. Louis this year. And tomatoes, remember, tomatoes are something that's a plant that likes it hot. You know, that plant's got to get up and get big enough. You know, if you're buying them in a pot or a six-pack, you know, from your local garden center, pinch those bottom two or three rows of leaves off and bury that stem 3 or 4 inches in the ground in your pot or in your garden, because all along that stem, what you see now are little root hairs. They'll turn into roots, and that just goes to the support of that plant. As the summer goes on, it'll be able to take up more moisture and more nutrients and therefore produce more tomatoes.
Well, Gene, we appreciate you calling in and let us know about that. I remember you calling and asking a question. And, I think the one thing I've learned doing this program is patience is key, and just don't fuss too much with stuff.
Right. I mean, we have become such the point-click society, right? Hey, you know, if my wife needs a new light bulb, I never have time to go to the hardware store because Amazon's showing up in the next 10 minutes at my house, it seems like.
Right.
But with plant material, that's not the world, right? It's not the world that we live in. It's not the world that they live in. So to get that stuff in the ground and give it time to grow, you know, if you're planting plants by seed and it says 60 to 90 days, 75 days to harvest, you get to the 75th day and you're probably ready to harvest. But that's a long way from Amazon, you know.
Yeah. Well, Mother Nature has its own clock.
Mm-hmm.
It does what it wants.
Yes. Yeah. So we just get to be stewards, right? We're just kind of hanging on, following our lead.
All right. Let's go to another phone call here. Bob, you're up next on the Garden Hotline with Chuck.
Yes. Good morning. I have some chrysanthemums that grow to about 3.5 feet tall in the fall and produce flowers. Right now, they're very bushy, and they're about 1.5 feet tall right now. When they get that tall, should I be cutting them back sometime during the summer so that they don't get that tall?
Yeah, chrysanthemums, almost any of those asters, right? So chrysanthemums or mums are in the aster family, and they will all respond to a cutting. And what I mean by that, or a pruning. And so typically you want to do that end of May, early June, so you're right in the right window to do that. And you can reduce that plant by as much as half. And then in every axil of all the leaf buds that are on those stems, that plant, then those little buds will turn on and it will create secondary branching, which again will double your flowers. So if you have goldenrod, you have New England asters, you have mums, all of that stuff you can pinch now. Another term for that is called the Chelsea chop. If you're a big fan of Chelsea English Botanic Gardens and all of that, that's what the Chelsea Gardens do to make sure that their flower shows in the fall are so fantastic. They literally whack their plants in half. So I've got a big native area at my house that right now is loaded with asters and goldenrod. And if you come to my house, about 50% of that stuff has been cut in half because I really want to see how well they do this coming fall. So, yeah, I would pinch them back.
All right. Thank you.
You bet, Bob.
Chrysanthemums. Say that 10 times in a row. That's what's tough.
Yeah.
Can I just call them mums? Or are there different
just
mums?
Amongst us friends. Yeah, we call them mums.
All right. The phone number is 314-436-7900. It is the Garden Hotline on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
From city lights to neighborhood stories, KMOX's local newsroom keeps you informed. The Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
It is the Garden Hotline on this Saturday, June 8th. Good morning. I'm Scott Jagow, along with Chuck Caverly, who is taking your questions about gardening topics. I do want to give an update on Mike Miller. His wife, Tracy, did post an update on his GoFundMe page. She says he's doing exercises while sitting during the day with his arms and legs. He isn't walking right now, but he's hoping to do normal things again at some point. It'll take time, she says, and he's being motivated to be where he needs to be. And part of that is people helping out financially on this GoFundMe page, because it does help with all the medical bills and the mortgage and all that kind of thing. So if you can participate, the name of the site on GoFundMe is Mike's Epilepsy. Just search for that and you'll find it. There's a picture of Mike and Tracy. You can read her update. So we're sending our best to them. Chuck is answering your questions this morning at 314-436-7900. And Chuck, you were saying that over the last few weeks, you've had people come up to you and say, "Hey, I heard you on the radio."
Yeah, it's kind of fun, right? So yeah. So I was actually at a Metro League Municipal League dinner, annual dinner, and a good friend of mine who is an attorney in town and a former mayor came up to me and he said, "You know, hey, I was listening to KMOX on Saturday morning, and there was this guy named Chuck Caverly answering plant material questions." And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Do you know that guy?" I'm like, "John, that was me, brother. That was me." And he goes, "I had no idea you've been doing this for 35 years. And I'm like, "Well, I have. It's a lot of fun. It's great." So it's fun that it's KMOX really is the fabric of St. Louis. I think it always has been. You know, growing up here as a kid, Saturday morning, whether my mom was in the kitchen or my dad was working out in the yard or in the garage, KMOX was always on. And the thing that people have told me over and over is, "Yeah, I was sitting in the kitchen with my tumbler coffee and listening with my wife, and man, you were right on," or, "Boy, did you blow that question," or, "How much do you know about hydrangeas?" And now they think I'm their personal answer man, you know, and I'm like, "Look, call in on Saturday morning. I'll look for your name and we may take your call."
Oh, no. You know? In the big head.
Yeah, there we go. But it's a lot of fun. It's you know, Mike Miller has always said that this is your show, right? This is the people's show, and his job is to help people navigate through their gardening. And he's 100% right. It makes fun. It's fun. I think gardening is so much a fabric of our lives, so much part of what. And just listening to Jean this morning, I mean, she was ecstatic because her potted tomato plant now has 11 blooms on it, where a week ago she just had one. I mean, the celebrations. My wife is like, "Hey, I got something to show you." And so we went out and picked black raspberries, not blackberries, but black raspberries the other night, brought them in, washed them off in cold water, and put them on a big scoop of vanilla ice cream. It was to die for. I mean, that's good stuff, right?
Yeah.
So it's fun. It's fun to be on the show, and it's great to talk about something that has been, you know, my vocation and my avocation my entire life.
Yeah, that's well said. And there's nothing, it's the little things in life and the joy that you get from creating something, growing something, and then putting it in your kitchen and eating it.
You're right.
You know?
So, right. So, with COVID, we've spent a lot of time studying, or some folks have spent a lot of time studying about our mental health and our physical health and what can we do, what things are different. And so they've come up with one of the practices that they've come up with and boiled down on is what's called the 3-30-300 rule. So if you can look out your window and see three trees, if you live in a neighborhood that has 30% canopy cover of trees, and if you are within 300 meters of a park where you can go and walk and get away from things, the quality of your life is exponentially higher than not. And so, and they've proven it. They've gone through and they've done the research, and not only your physical health, but your mental well-being as well. And so it just goes to show you, you know, that, that plant material and living in amongst nature is really a key to our success. How many times did you read during COVID, they said, oh, I was doing some tree calming out in our park. I was sitting underneath trees, just taking in the tree's energy. Well, I'm not so touchy-feely on tree energy, although I'm an arborist, but the well-being that you get when you're in nature is undeniable, and now they've proven it, and they've proven that it's an important part of our lives. So it's kind of cool.
Oh, come on, Chuck. You're a tree hugger.
Yeah, well, okay. on any given day, maybe.
No, it's kind of wild to think about Mother Nature in all of its scope. It's a vengeful thing. And it's terrible when we have these tragedies with hurricanes and tornadoes and landslides and volcanoes. And you just think about all the death that occurs. But at the same time, of course, there's a cycle where there's so much life going on. It's bringing us life,
right,
while also enhancing our lives. So
yeah, and to sit down and just take the silly cicadas, right? These 17-year and 13-year or 14-year broods. The idea that an insect comes out, becomes an adult, mates, lays their eggs. The eggs fall off the tree branches, fall back to the ground. The eggs hatch. This small little caterpillar, this little worm, drives down into the ground and starts sucking the sap out of a tree root for the next 13 years. I mean, who figured that thing out, right? I mean, you would never go into the lab as a scientist or an engineer and say, okay, we're going to build a car that we only have to fill up with gas every 13 years. You know, I mean, what? How would we do? It's just crazy science, right? It's just fun how it all comes together. I read an article this week and been asked to work on a project that says that 29% of our birds since 1970 are gone. Right, the bird count, not necessarily 29% of our species, but the total overall population of our songbirds is down by 29%. So there's people like the Missouri Department of Conservation, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Audubon Group, the Missouri River Bird Observatory. They're all partnering to come up with how do we continue, how do we change the environment? How do we change our look on things to make things better for birds? It's just a cool way of trying to put all the pieces together because it's all interrelated. We're all here.
To use a title from a documentary from a few years ago, we live on one strange rock.
Yeah.
It was narrated by Will Smith. And if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend.
One Strange Rock. I'm writing that one down.
One Strange Rock. It just goes back to the beginning of time, the beginning of the earth, and how it evolved through plants and animals and people and just the unbelievable coincidences that had to occur for us to be here today.
Yeah,
doing a radio show on Saturday morning.
Pretty amazing.
It is. So I highly recommend checking that out. It's called One Strange Rock. Our phone number is 314-436-7900. Chuck is eager to answer your questions. Do you got anything specific in June that you like to talk about?
Well, June is Rose Month. So if you're a big rose fan, that means you're beginning to keep your eye out for the pesky Japanese beetle, which is an imported pest that we run into. Lots of ways to treat it. Probably the least obtrusive way is with warm, soapy water on your plants because they fly around so much, it's hard to really get control of them. They love rosacea stuff. They love grapevines. They love linden trees. A lot of times if you have linden trees, they'll start at the top, so you hardly notice they're there. But again, they come and they go. There is a methodology of grub control, you know, that we think about grubs and when do you put the grub control down ideally. And if you monitor the number of June bugs or June beetles at your porch light overnight, that population where you may have one or two a night, then it'll go four or six, then it'll go 10 or 12, and then all of a sudden that number drops off to zero. And so from that drop-off point, it takes 28 days for that June beetle's eggs to hatch and for it to begin to start growing on our grass roots or eating our grass roots, which everybody hates grubs, right? Grub control. And so 28 days after is when you want to be putting down that grub control in your yard. So that's not now. It's not June 1st, but it's going to be sometime in July. We're going to be looking for that.
Well, I like grub. I just don't like grubs.
Yeah, that's correct. Well, they're high protein, I've been told. But
no,
that might
we're not going there.
That might be
we're
a Dr. Millet kind of thing.
We're not going there. We've already talked plenty about eating cicadas, which is ridiculous. We're not going about talking about grubs. But yeah, June bugs, this is their month.
Yeah. Yeah, they're coming on. And that's and it's just part of their life. So, you know, when you think about herbicides for weeds, we think about insecticides for pests. But remember this, for every bad insect that we run into, there's 170 beneficial insects that if you have a robust garden and a robust yard, you're supporting those other 170 species. And in those 170 species are the predators that eat the bad guys.
All right, the phone calls are coming in, and after this break, we are going to get to the phone lines, 314-436-7900. It's the Garden Hotline on KMOX.
For everything St. Louis Cardinals, it's Cardinals Conversations. Use the Odyssey app or hear it on your favorite podcast platform. From game analysis, player and management interviews, it's exclusive Cardinals content from KMOX Sports, where the Redbird talk never stops.
It is the Garden Hotline on a Saturday morning. Good morning. I'm Scott Jagow, along with Chuck Caverly, who's here to answer your questions. 314-436-7900. Let's go to the phones. Joanne, you are up next on the Garden Hotline.
Hi. We live in Chesterfield, and we've had a ton of cicadas. I mean, I have friends who live in other parts of the city, and it's not as bad. And I wondered if it's a, they say it doesn't affect the plants. But something we have this year that we've never had before, and that is not sometimes you have, like, leaves drop. They turn yellow off of trees. We've got, like, clumps, like three or four or five leaves all together. And if you, like, walk around the neighborhood and you look, it's not just my yard. People look like they have clumps on their yards. Any idea what's causing that?
Sure. So what happens in the life cycle is after the cicadas do their business, the female cicada has a part of her anatomy is called the ovipositor. And so there's a pair of jaws, essentially, that scars or will pierce the underside of a stem. And she'll do that six or eight times, and she'll lay, you know, 5 to 10 eggs in every time she does that. And so there'll be a length. If you look on the underside of those branches that are laying on the ground, those small twigs, you'll see a row of what looks like somebody took a really fine penknife and just pierced the bark. And so what it ends up doing is creating a weak spot, and then when we get a good thunderstorm that blows through with 30 or 40 miles an hour winds, those weak spots break off, right? The branch can't hold on anymore, so they break off and they fall to the ground. Or they just break off half of the way, and so they'll be hanging straight down, and then the leaves that were green now turn brown, so it looked like somebody did a very poor job of pruning on your trees. And that is a result of that female cicada laying her eggs on the underside of those twigs. So one way to think about it is Mother Nature is providing a little selective pruning for your trees. The other part of the is just to wait another month. You know, the cicadas will be gone, and those responses will fall apart. If the branches don't fall off, a lot of times you'll see callus tissue where the tree has grown around that little cut, that little slice that the female cicada made. And so the tree will try to naturally callus over and support that growth. But that will always be a weak spot probably for the next year or two on that tree.
Okay. I mean, you know, when you hear that cicadas don't do any damage and then you see all these clumps of leaves, I'm thinking, okay.
Yeah, great. So damage is relative, right? Do they do damage? They certainly have an impact on the trees. Is it life-altering for the tree? Most likely not, unless they all pile on, you know, maybe a small dogwood that you just put in the ground this year.
Okay.
I know they typically, you know, I haven't seen any activity on evergreen trees. I don't know that for a fact. They seem to like oaks and dogwoods and redbuds and everything else with a leaf on it. Anywhere where they can find that young, soft growth, they'll drop in that that female will go to town.
Well, thank you for the information.
You bet. Glad to help.
Thank you for the question, Joanne. Up next, Wayne, you are on the Garden Hotline with Chuck Caverly.
Yes, sir. I got a question. Being first part of June, and we go to Snooks or Deerberg, where is the best, closest tomato as to a Missouri homegrown tomato?
So which is the best cultivar to go to the Missouri homegrown?
Yes.
That's a great question, because I think there's only 5 or 10 commercially grown cocktail tomatoes and probably 20 different or more commercially grown regular red tomatoes, you know, like you would find in the store. I know there's quite a few heirloom varieties. I know that if you go to places like Thies's Vegetable Market, or if you go downtown, like Scott was saying earlier, down at Soulard or the Kirkwood, any place that's got a farmer's market, you're going to get the local Missouri or Illinois tomatoes. And they're just starting to come on. You know, a lot of plants that we planted, some at we have a project at work that we did a little vegetable garden for. They're starting to set fruit. My tomatoes at home are starting to set fruit. But the 1st of June would be early for truly St. Louis, you know, within 30 miles I hear red tomatoes, unless they're growing them commercially, you know, maybe in a hothouse or something. So do I have a favorite variety? Not really, as long as it goes with good bacon and toast on a BLT. I'm pretty good. And like I said, those cocktail tomatoes for your salads or your pasta salad, they're just hard to beat. The Sweet 100s are probably my favorite cultivar of those cocktail tomatoes.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
All right, thanks, Wayne. Yeah, you can't really go wrong at the farmer's market with tomatoes most of the time. I don't think I've ever gotten a terrible tomato at a farmer's market.
Yeah, and part of the reason why they taste so good is they've been on the vine and they've ripened, right, all the way through. A lot of times when they're produced commercially, they're actually picked green, and then they go through an ethanol bath. And that ethanol is what stimulates the ripening. And so you might find a pretty red perimeter, but it's still a green interior, and it doesn't taste real good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of that process.
Well, so, I do have a follow-up question there. So if you do, say, go to farmer's market and get fresh tomatoes, how long will they last before? Let's say you get a bunch of them and you want to eat them over the next few days. I mean, how long can that go on before they spoil?
I think it really really depends on how long, you know, how long they've been off the vine, how long they've been treated. You know, one of the things that we do in the fall time is when right before frost, we'll pick all of our green tomatoes and we'll put them in a paper bag so we can keep that gas, that ethanol that they naturally release to help ripen the whole group of them, right? So if you buy 8 or 12 tomatoes because you're not going to go to the store for the next 2 weeks, then I would not keep them all in the same location, right? I'd spread them out a little bit. You know, we all know that when you buy bananas and they ripen, and a ripe banana is truly a brown banana, but they put off a ton of that ethanol gas that helps that fruit ripen the rest of the way. And bananas will cause tomatoes to ripen. Anytime they're releasing that ethanol is really the kind of the active component to ripening.
So you would keep them in?
I would segregate them, and I think you could put them in the fridge. Me, I like them on the kitchen counter.
Yeah.
And if they start to spoil, then that just means I haven't been eating them enough.
Right. But not in the bag?
Not in the bag. No, okay. I would leave them open.
Okay.
Yeah, let the air circulate around them.
All right, we are going to continue with your phone calls in just a moment on the Garden Hotline. The number is 314-436-7900. We had some more calls come in. We'll take your questions with Chuck Caverly after this. And Chuck, I have a topic I want to bring up that I just realized is happening this weekend, today, in fact. So stay tuned for that.
Oh, my.
Gone South has been a podcast about crime in the American South. But for our new season, we're widening the lens. Follow and listen to Gone South Season 5, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows.
This is the St. Louis Composting Garden Hotline with Mike Miller on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Good morning. I'm Scott Jagow, along with Chuck Caverly, who is taking your questions on all things gardening. Pat, you are up next on the Garden Hotline.
Hi, good morning. The hailstorm that came through here on Memorial Weekend really damaged my hostas for the most, a lot of other things, but for the most part, I'm concerned with the hostas. They're shredded. The leaves are just completely shredded. And before you answer, I guess the question is there anything I can do to facilitate their recovery? And then again, before you answer, I miss Mike Miller, but I really want to congratulate and commend the people that have been taking his place. Everybody has just been wonderful and doing a great job.
Well, thank you for that. And Chuck?
What great words. Thank you. So your hostas, so if you thought about all of a sudden your hostas were invaded by deer overnight and they ate all of that fleshy tissue and left just the stems, right? So it would look like you were growing celery, perhaps. Hail has kind of done the same thing. So it shredded that big leaf surface. So there's two things you could do. If you really wanted to get rid of the ugly color, you know, and the ugly leaves, you could go out and prune those leaves with a pair of hand pruners and just snip them back as close to the base that you can get. There's probably some leaves beneath that top layer that probably aren't as beat up as the top ones are. And if that's the case, they would do fine. That plant, with the moisture that we're getting, the temperatures that we're getting, that plant, once it loses that photosynthetic producer, you know, that engine that leaf is, it will replenish. So it's going to pulse energy stores out of its root mass, and it will push new leaves. And they may not be as big as the ones that you have now, but it will recover. It will respond. Because, you know, every plant is planning for next year or the following year. So those buds are there and or the meristematic tissues will push out new growth. So I would tell you, if you want to get rid of the nasty leaves, just simply snip those, prune those off, and then be patient. I wouldn't fertilize it. I wouldn't throw any more extra water to it. Mother Nature's taking care of your water quotient for you. So that might be your best bet.
Pat?
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you, Pat.
Thanks for the question, and that's a good one. Yeah, hail. I didn't think about that. We were talking about Mother Nature and destruction.
Nature.
Hail does a lot of
She's
damage.
She's a fickle girl, that Mother Nature.
I know. All right, Bunny, you're up next with Chuck Caverly. Hello, Bunny.
Hi. I have a question about, I have a holly bush, and it's just huge. Well, it's starting to hit my car when I come out of the driveway, so I'm going to have to cut some of that off. What is a good time to prune a holly bush?
So for pruning, there's always two times to do it, right? The first time is the horticulturally correct time, and the second time is necessity. So if that holly bush is impacting your ability to back out of your garage or to walk down your front sidewalk, I would tell you it's time to prune it.
Having, I can cut that. Okay, that's fine. And prune the whole thing at what time of the year?
So hollies, I would wait until either they flower, which is early spring, or I would do it just before or right after Thanksgiving. And the reason I would do it right after Thanksgiving is because those holly branches make great green decorations for your inside, you know, for a little interior holiday decorating, if you're into that. But I think, in general, I would wait until fall to head them back if you want to be a little more aggressive for that whole shrub.
Wait till fall. Okay. Mm-hmm. Another question I have about peaches. There are peaches in the store now from Georgia, and they're not good. And I thought, isn't it a little early for peaches?
Well, gee, Bunny, it's a little early to pick on Georgia as a state, but I would just tell you that, you know, the further south we go, the longer their growing season is. So for every 100 miles we go south means there's another week earlier in the spring that those plants begin to produce, and they'll hold a week longer in the fall, right? So there's a much longer growing season down there. Part of the reason why they're not as maybe tasty as you would prefer them is because they've picked at a point where they can be boxed and shipped by a machine. So that really good soft texture that you like feeling in your hand with that peach, knowing that that softness represents real good juicy interior, isn't there because the plants just, you know, those peaches haven't ripened. Now, I'd put them in a window and let them sit for a week or maybe 2 weeks to see if that will help soften them up. And what that does, it just allows that flesh to go ahead and mature a little bit more and add a little more flavor.
Okay, but it really is too early, isn't it? Yeah, I thought you got peaches the end of July.
That's around here. That's when they're the best.
All right, Bunny, thank you for the question. 314-436-7900 is the number. That is the Garden Hotline. And Richard, you are up next.
I have morning. I have two mature magnolia trees out front of my house, and they're beautiful, but they're also a mess when they shed their leaves. And in the drought, they shed them all every day.
Right.
Is there anything I can do to recycle the leaves?
So you could put the leaves in a compost box, or, you know, and do it that way. You could also mulch them, you know, with a push mower, with a bagging attachment, and create a really nice leaf mulch and use maybe in other parts of your yard. My guess is you're talking about the big southern grand magnolia, Magnolia grandiflora, which is the big heavy-duty waxy leaf variety. And yeah, they're a funny plant. They seem to drop their leaves all the time, especially now that they're done flowering.
Okay, but I can cut them up and, you know, they will mulch?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they would do great for you.
All right. Thanks for the question, Richard. Chuck Caverly is answering them on the Garden Hotline this morning. And we're going to continue with your phone calls after the top of the hour news. And I want to talk about something that's happening in the region today I'm very excited about. We'll find out in just a few minutes.
Now, at your service. Welcome to the St. Louis Composting Garden Hotline with Mike Miller on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Filling in for Mike today, answering your gardening questions, it's Chuck Caverly. He's been on the show before and has shown off his knowledge of a thing or two. The number is 314-436-7900. Let's go back to the phones. Christy, you are up next on the Garden Hotline.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about fringe trees. We have two of them. They're about 6 years old. They get plenty of mix of sun, direct sun and shade, plenty of water. They just don't seem to flower much, hardly any at all. Others in my neighborhood have trees that are flowering abundantly. Is there anything I could or should be doing to encourage the flowering?
So you said they're 6 years old. Do you remember which fringe tree that you planted? So there's two of them typically available in the marketplace. There's one that's native to Missouri and one that's not native to Missouri.
The native one,
yeah. So it probably needs a little more time in the ground to do its thing, right? And so 6 years is, you're just 3 years past that sleep, creep, and leap, you know, establishment period. A lot of those native flowering trees can be sensitive sometimes to a late cold snap or a late frost. I know my native one at my house did very well this spring, and my non-native ones were kind of pretty lackluster. So, if you've got the ground mulched beneath it with a good organic mulch, like a compost as opposed to just bark mulch, that compost is going to help leach that really good nutrient material back into the plant to help round it out. And then I would not be one to overwater that plant this summer, you know, just because it doesn't tend to like really, really wet feet. Being native, it can dry out pretty easily, you know, and still be okay. So
okay.
That's the way I would look at it. sometimes it might be just a matter of it doesn't get quite enough sunshine, right? So it may need another hour or two of sunshine. So if you've got it planted as an understory plant, it might be helpful that you might limb up the oak or maple or something that might be available or that might be growing above it. If that's the way it is, that might be a game changer as well.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Christy, for your question. Doug, you're up next on the Garden Hotline. What's yours?
Yes, along the same line of the mulch. I use cypress mulch all the time. It doesn't seem to deteriorate as quick as others and turn into soil, and that's why I don't use regular mulch, because regular mulch deteriorates and everything and just basically turns into dirt, which is basically a breeding area for plants coming up. Is there any real advantage to using cypress mulch over other mulches?
So, you know, we use all kinds of things, right, in our industry in St. Louis. You can find rubber mulch that's been recycled from tires, cypress mulch, pine nuggets. People use lava rock, of all things, as a mulch, you know, as a ground cover. But if you think about the organic life of the tree or the shrub, you know, and I understand that we seem to have this this obsession with weeds, that we don't want weeds in our bed. And so we try to find the right mulch, whether it's premium ground hardwood mulch or a triple ground bark mulch or whatever it is. And I would tell you part of the purpose of that mulch is, yes, to help suppress weeds. But there's two types of weed sources. One of them is in the natural seed catch in the soil. And the other is the seeds that get blown in or dropped by birds every year. So whether it's gravel or cypress mulch or oak bark mulch or hardwood mulch, all of those, you're going to have to deal with weeds at some component. I would tell you that if you're being successful with the cypress mulch because it doesn't break down as quickly and it helps suppress the weeds for you, if that's working for you, then I would continue to do that. If you were mulching 35 or 45 yards of mulch at a time, cypress mulch is probably going to put a pretty big hit to your bank account. Whereas if you've got a small garden area where you can grab a bag or two of it and be successful because it lasts longer, I would tell you there's nothing wrong with that.
Okay, thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. So, Chuck, do you know what's happening today in Collinsville?
Collinsville, Illinois?
Yep.
Is it the Onion Festival?
No, it is the International Horseradish Festival.
Oh, I should have known that. It's favorite route. Nothing like a good nose-clearing, sinus-clearing bite of horseradish.
Totally agree. Do you know why Collinsville is the horseradish capital of the world?
You know, I have no idea.
Really?
Why? No, I don't. I know that
specifically why horseradish grows so well in Collinsville.
I have no idea.
Well, I looked it up. It's a thing called Google. Anyway, so the Mississippi River used to be much wider in right. this area, and that left the soil to be rich in potash.
Oh.
Potassium.
Yeah.
And so it's an important nutrient for horseradish growth.
Yeah. Potash, tomato.
We'll see.
Yeah.
You know,
I love it.
I'm not the gardening expert. You are. But I am bringing a little knowledge here.
Yeah.
Also, the other place in the world that is sort of a capital for growing horseradish is Hungary.
Hungary, which is perfect. Right? The Europeans need something over there because they're always so... Yeah, I mean, it's just different over there.
You're not about to get political, are you?
No, sir. No, I was just going to try to make a bad joke about they're always hungry and hungry.
Okay.
Sorry, that doesn't really qualify.
But. And horseradish is a member of what family?
I think that's is it the Brassicaceae or is it in the Umbel family?
I was going to say mustard.
Mustard, yeah.
The mustard
Brassicaceae.
Family.
Oh, yeah.
Well.
Yeah, Cruciferae Brassicaceae.
You're not speaking my language now.
Yeah,
mustard
sorry.
Is my
I had
language.
To pull rank.
Ketchup
I
and
went,
mustard are my language.
I went
language.
Strictly Latin to try to baffle you. So, yeah, Brassicaceae. Yeah. So it's super cool, right? We planted some at our house a year ago. The leaves are great. I mean, if you think about it, they're kind of a funky looking like hosta leaf. So they really work great in your yard. And there's nothing better than fresh ground horseradish on a little corned beef.
Corned beef. Okay. So my original hometown of Buffalo, New York has a very local specialty called beef on weck. It is Kimmelwick rolls. They are seeded, salty buns, and they only last for a day. So you got to eat them that day after they come out of the oven. Anyway, this delicacy, as we call it in upstate, in western New York, is roast beef on one of these Kimmelwick rolls, and then you put horseradish on top of it. It's unbelievable. And yes, a time or two in my life, I have had things come out of my nose after eating.
There's, you know, when it takes your breath away,
I know
that you got to
get
stuff.
I know.
Yeah.
But then after you do it, you're like, maybe I shouldn't have put that much horseradish
right.
on it.
Right. You know,
but the
onions,
hotter the better.
Onions can make you cry.
So horseradish,
horseradish can make you lose all of your cranial body fluids. I mean,
that's true.
You know, your sinuses clear out, your tear ducts clear out, your nose just, it's fantastic.
There's probably going to be a lot of people crying in Collinsville today.
I should only hope so. That's right. Envious of their experience.
All right, the Garden Hotline is 314-436-7900. Chuck Caverly is answering your questions, and we'll continue with your phone calls in just a moment on KMOX.
KMOX, our focus is you, your go-to station for local news that matters to St. Louis and the region. The voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
That's right. Our focus on KMOX is you. And this morning, it is at your service, the Garden Hotline, with Chuck Caverly answering your questions. Off the air, we were just talking about allyl isothiocyanate.
Sounds like something that might be an irritant to one's sinal pathways or something.
AITC. It is found in mustard, radish, horseradish, and wasabi. So that's what causes your sinuses
to unleash
and that, you know, unbelievable.
Oh, it's so good.
It's not a pepper hot. It's a different.
No,
it's not in your mouth hot. It's in your sinus.
It's in your sinuses.
So I don't think there's a scale. You know, they have the Scoville scale for peppers.
Peppers, right.
I just think it's
I've never eaten a red pepper and had my breath taken away. Right. I mean, I might tear up. I might start pouring sweat out of my head and my ears and everything. But I've never had my breath taken away. Horseradish will take your breath away. That's pretty cool.
Have you had a Carolina Reaper?
No, I tend to stay away from everything solanaceous.
Yeah. You'll have your breath taken away.
Yeah, no, I'm not a pepper guy. Yeah. I'm not a hot pepper guy. Not at all. No way.
We're talking about this because it is the International Horseradish Festival in the horseradish capital of the world, which is right here in Collinsville, Illinois. Let's go back to the phones. Sue, you're up next on the Garden Hotline.
Hi, I have two questions. One about our button bush. We've had it in the ground 2 years, and it gets afternoon sun. But all we get is those little buttons. We never get it to flower.
Right. So the button bush is Cephalanthus occidentalis, which is a really cool native shrub. It likes wet feet. So if you've got a wet spot in your yard, and they'll do okay in dry locations as well. So mine at home. That little button, the flower starts out, looks almost like a miniature sweet gum ball, if you think about it.
Yeah.
And then it gets to maybe an inch in diameter, and then it flowers. And it doesn't flower for an extended period of time. When it does flower, the butterflies just go absolutely nuts for it. So if you've only had it in the ground for 2 years, it's going to take a little more time for that guy really to get going and get big. I did a planting a number of years ago down off of Michigan Avenue for a lovely gal who was going all natives in her yard, and she wanted a shrub hedge in her backyard, and it was wet. And we put in a row of button bush. Today, those button bush are maybe 8 to 10 feet tall and 8 to 10 foot across, and she has no idea that she has neighbors on that side of her yard. They're just fantastic. That it's a big leaf, right? So it's a big glossy green leaf. Doesn't do much for fall color, but man, is it fantastic for butterflies, and it really loves wet feet.
And we got the little Henry next to it.
Oh yeah.
Wondering about that too.
Yeah, so the little Henry is an Itea. It's an Itea, a sweet spire. So it's Itea virginiana, which is actually native to the state, a little in the further southern part of the state, you might find it. The Henry and the little Henrys refer to cultivars called Henry's Garnet, which the lee surface tends to be a real burgundy plant. And that plant's really cosmopolitan in its life. It can do a dry parking lot island, and it stays within itself. Or if you've got a wet, marshy area, it will take off, and it will sucker, and it will spread. And they're both great. That has a little white inflorescence of flowers that hang down that are very attractive, and pollinators love those as well too. So those are two great shrubs for wet spots. And if you got wet spots, they're fantastic.
When is that supposed to flower?
Mine are flowering at home now, and they're kind of in a lot of shade. But they're still flowering, and so it should be now. They might be waning. They might be kind of to the end of their flower season. I typically think of them as a May flower.
Yeah, we didn't get any flowers.
And how long have you had those in the ground? Just 2 years?
Oh, that's 3 years.
Yes.
Right, Bill? They flowered last year, but nothing this year.
Yeah. So
a wet area, all of them.
Right, but you didn't trim them or didn't snip on them, right? You just let them be.
Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
So let them be, and then just make sure you got a good organic compost mulch around them to help make sure that the nutrients are in the soil that are real, really helpful, and I think they'll come on. Give them a chance.
Okay.
Yeah, you'll
thank
like
you
them.
So I do. We do. Thank you.
Good.
All right, thank you, Sue. The number is 314-436-7900. Bruce, you are up next on the Garden Hotline for Chuck.
Yes, maybe a month or two ago, you were talking about Scottish link grass seed.
Yes, sir.
And I've got an area that's heavily dense with small trees and that. It's on a creek bottom hedge. I'm thinking about putting that there, but I can't find it on the east side in any of the nurseries.
Yeah, it's nothing like talking about a really cool grass mix that nobody can find. So I apologize for that. You can probably get it special order through a good seed house. So maybe the Belleville Seed House or one of those guys over there might be able to special order for it. It comes out of Oregon. It's out of a seed group. Used to be Jacqueline Seed, and I think they've been purchased. I would tell you that there's a seed mix that's part of provided by G.R. Robinson. It's called one of George's Magic's mixes. That's a shade mix that they sell. It has some bluegrass in it, but it has a lot of these fine fescues in it as well. And it's those real fine-bladed fescues that like the dry shade, not a lot of water, will do well as an understory plant. And, you know, Tower Grove Park is beginning to use it and with great success in areas where they don't have to mow every week. Because the plant only gets, 4 to 8 inches tall and just kind of hangs out. So it's underneath the weed radar. It's a really soft plant or a soft mix. So you might try George's Magic Mix, his shade blend would also be a good alternative for you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bruce. We're taking your questions for Chuck Caverly. And Tom, you are up next on the Garden Hotline.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. You were just talking about various kinds of mulches. Would the wood mulches ever be home to termites, or is any chance of termites, coming into any of the wood mulches as they break down?
Sure. So, termites are feeders on wood. So, and what I mean by that specifically is wood as opposed to bark. So if you remember your early biology or botany classes where you talk about phloem and xylem cells, well, in a herbaceous plant, they're organized a little bit differently than what we would find in a woody tree. So the woody tree has that cambium layer where the xylem cells go to the inside of the tree and become wood, and the phloem cells become bark. So those phloem cells are usually they're the protective tissues, right? They're the protective lining of those trees. And so when those trees have a healthy bark and not injured, insects like termites can't get in and do their job. If you if you take wood mulch or mulch that just comes out of a chipper that may be a ground and composted in ground, it will have wood fiber in it, and those termites can find that wood fiber and they'll go after it. If your bark is only bark mulch and you can buy just a hardwood bark mulch specifically that's made as offal from the forestry industry in the state of Missouri, you know, we harvest a lot of oak trees in Missouri. We harvest a lot of pine trees out of the Mark Twain Forest. And so in that lumber process, in that milling process, they strip off all the bark. The big bark, you know, mulch guys in town or across the state, they'll go to those lumber mills. They buy that from them, that offal from them. Then they grind it and compost it, and that's what becomes that bark mulch. So if you're worried about termites, go with the oak bark mulch as opposed to just a generic wood mulch.
Okay, very good. I've been wondering about that for several years. For containers, do bone or blood meal, are they helpful for tomatoes and peppers, or is that just kind of a waste?
So, you know, most of our container mixes are soilless mixes, you know, like a Miracle-Gro potting mix or something. And so almost all of those things are sterile. And so what we really need in that soil mix is an organic component that has living microorganisms in it. As an alternative to that sterile mix, we add time-release fertilizers. You can add a bone meal or a blood meal because they're adding a lot of the micronutrients that those tomatoes need to really to prosper and do well. And so it certainly wouldn't hurt. I would just follow your label directions so you don't put too much of it in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. And then finally, what about potting mix versus potting soil for, container tomatoes and peppers and flowers?
Yeah, so if it were me, I would grab, because those potting mixes, again, they're sterile, they're soilless, they allow a lot of percolation, they add a lot of root growth, but those roots need to be taking up, they need to have exposure to the microorganisms that naturally in the soil. So what we do at our home is we mix a good compost in with that soilless mix for all of our raised beds and all of our pots. And we will also mix in a lot of organic material, whether it be pine needles or compost out of the vegetable compost, or even some, mulched up or ground up leaf matter. So you really want to create a mix that has a little bit of everything in it. Potting soil versus potting mix, they're all sterile. Right. So they're missing the one component that plant really needs to get it to take off the rest of the way.
All right.
Okay. Very good. Very good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Tom. We appreciate it. Chuck Caverly is answering your questions on the Garden Hotline. If you have a burning question about gardening, you can't wait to ask. You have about 20 minutes. So get to it. It's 314-436-7900. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Cardinals second baseman Nolan Gorman. It's game day.
It's the Cards and Rockies this afternoon. Amron Total Access 220. First pitch 3:15.
Let's play ball.
On your voice of the Cardinals, KMOX.
It is the Garden Hotline on a Saturday morning, kind of a cloudy morning, June 8th. Chuck Caverly is here answering your questions. And we did an update last hour about Mike Miller. Tracy posted something on Facebook. I'm sorry, not Facebook. GoFundMe, the page, which is Mike's Epilepsy. If you are interested in getting that update and reading about his recovery and also possibly donating to help out with the situation there. But he is not walking right now, but trying to do whatever exercises he can. And if we get something else, we will pass it along to you. Okay, so Chuck is answering your questions now, and we have some phone calls. Let's go to Kelly. You're up next on the Garden Hotline.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I had a large tree taken down from my front yard in November, and there's nothing going on in my lawn. It's mostly weeds. There are a lot of dry, bald spots, and I'm just wondering what might work in that space and when is the best time to start seeding?
So, you know, ideal time, my assumption would be that you'd want a cool grass lawn, which would be fescue, like turf-type tall fescues or bluegrass. So, Kelly, the ideal time of the year to do that is going to be late August, early September. Gives a chance for the plants, the new grass plants to come up before you get into raking leaves, or in this case, raking your neighbor's leaves, perhaps. And so, the bare spots that you have now, you know, if you don't have a lawn program, if you didn't put down your pre-emergent herbicide this spring, you could go out and with a fork or a cultivator and cultivate those rough spots and or those brown spots, dry spots, and throw a little seed down, rake it over, and water it. But now you're going to be kind of hooked into watering. And we're going into the driest part of our season here in the next, you know, 4 to 8 weeks. So I would tell you, you know, as far as weed control goes, I'm a big believer in a 1 gallon pump up sprayer. You mix up 1 gallon of Weed Begone at a time. You go out and spray that 1 gallon and then you rinse it out, put it back in the garage. And next week you might do it again. Otherwise, you know, you're going to drive yourself nuts trying to treat the whole thing all at one time. So, build on your successes and then get ready to really seed heavy in September. And I would do a double pass core aeration and then broadcast your seed after that.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much.
You bet. Glad you called this morning.
All right, up next, Donna, what is your question for Chuck Caverly?
Morning. I have an unusual situation. I recently purchased a red scarlet dogwood tree, and when it arrived in the mail, it was broken in half. It had been about 3 feet tall. It was a beautiful little tree, and I was heartbroken to see that broken like that. I kept the lower half, which is about 14 inches, and it is growing leaves at the top of the where I pruned it off, but yet the leaves are more of a chartreuse-like color. This tree was supposed to grow to about 20 to 25 feet. I'm just questioning how much height do you think this tree will grow? Is it going to grow maybe half that amount of height, or what do you have to say about that?
So dogwoods are kind of what they call indiscriminate dominant. In other words, there's no main central leader. So horticulturally, when they're grown in the field, those nurserymen really work hard to create a classic tree, right? So in our mind's eye, we think of a single trunk with branches coming off of it on all sides. But dogwoods, if you look at dogwoods that naturally exist, they might have 6 or 8 branches that go up to help make part of the canopy of the tree. So that little guy that got broken off, unfortunately, if you did a nice clean pruning job at the break and have got it established where it's growing, then I would sit back and make sure it's got plenty of mulch, keep a close eye on its water this year, let it get established. There's no reason why you can't expect it to get to 20 feet in height over time, but time is going to be probably 10 to 15 years before it gets that tall. Right. It would have been 12 to 15 years with the good guy before it got broken. So it will come on, and you've made it an investment in it. It came in the mail. And so I would give it a time to show you that it's capable of doing what you want it to do.
Sounds good. I have one other quick question. After that happened, I went and ordered another one. Another tree came, and this one is still in its little pot. And the grower, I contacted them to tell them that, I guess due to the heat we had, all the leaves on this little tree are like potato chips. They're real crunchy.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, she says, to put it in the ground and just keep it watered. She said the leaves should come back. Is that your take on it?
My take would be I would put it in the ground, I would get it watered in, I would maintain it, and then it will probably push a new set of leaves. Remember earlier I said plants are always planning for next year, and so in the case that those leaves all got burned off, it'll push a new set of growth, most likely, which means then as soon as it does that, it's going to start planning for next year. So I would keep the water on it all season long, you know, a good soaking once a week all through the summertime for the both of those dogwoods, and I think you'll be successful.
Okay. That's just what I wanted to hear. Okay. Thanks, Chuck. Have a great day.
Thank you, Donna. Bye-bye. You too.
All right. Let's continue with the phone calls. Up next, Kay, you're on the Garden Hotline.
Thank you for answering all our questions. We appreciate this. I noticed that when I'm buying potted plants, flowers, the soil isn't soil. It feels like a sponge.
Exactly right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's what they call a soilless mix. So if you think about it, that grower wants to be able to control all of the conditions. And so if they start with a soilless mix that's sterile, they're not worried about any fungal pathogens or diseases or bacteria or any of that. That's the good news for them. And then they provide the nutrients that that plant needs into that spongy, soilless mix, either granular or liquid as the plant grows. What needs to take place is once you get that out and when you go to plant it in your yard, you want to cultivate that soil right there where you're putting that plant in. And it would be helpful if you've got some compost to mix a little compost in every time you put that pot. I just spoke with my brother yesterday, and he was telling me about, well, Chuck, every time I put in a plant, I go to my compost bin and I grab a scoopful of compost and I mix it in with the soil and put it all back in. That's 100% accurate. That's the way to do it. So I would just encourage you to know that that's a real spongy. It's soilless. It allows for lots of plants to be produced very easily by the grower. And in theory, that should help keep the cost down for the rest of us.
Okay, what if I want to keep the it's a flowering plant.
Mm-hmm.
I want to keep it in that pot. Do I just have to water it a lot because it seems to dry out very fast?
Yeah, so you might try putting a saucer on the bottom and then watering mm-hmm. the saucer and allow the moisture to come up into the plant as opposed from the top down. And then that way, if you got a little granular, a little time release, Miracle-Gro, well, I don't think Miracle-Gro makes a time release, but there's some granular fertilizers out there by Fertilome and a couple other producers that you could get at your local garden center. That's a time release, like a 3 to 4 month or an 8 to 9 month. So you don't have to go out with Miracle-Gro and put it down every 2 weeks, right? You just do it one time, and that'll feed that plant for the whole season.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Kay. Have a great day.
Same to you.
Thanks for your call. It is 314-436-7900, the Garden Hotline on KMOX. Chuck Caverly taking your questions. Stay tuned. We'll have more of them just ahead.
This is the St. Louis Composting Garden Hotline with Mike Miller on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Just a few minutes left on this Saturday morning with Chuck Caverly answering your questions. So our challenge now is to get through as many questions as we can in the next 5 minutes. Let's go. Larry, you're up first.
Hey, good morning, Chuck. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I've got a question. I have a tree line behind my home that separates me from my neighbor's property, and I would just like to introduce some understory shrubs and bushes into that, and I'm wondering what would do well in the shade of those trees. It really doesn't get much sun there at all.
So just three quick suggestions for you. Anything in the viburnum group would do fantastic for you in that kind of partial sun, partial shade, or heavy shade would do uh-huh. well. Annabelle hydrangeas or the straight hydrangea arborescens would do well back there. And then the third choice for you might be a spice bush, which is a little bit different kind of shrub, but it's got a burgundy flower. I have some at my house. I planted them 3 years ago out of a 5-gallon pot, and I think they're probably 8 feet tall now, hold their leaves late. So they're your three wow. quick suggestions.
Great. Thank All you right. very much, Chuck. I hope you have a great day.
Same to you, sir.
Thanks, Larry. Chris, you're up next on the Garden Hotline.
Well, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. First, I want to say thanks for the update on Mike Miller. We'll keep him in our prayers, and I'm sure he's proud of the job you're doing. You're doing a great job answering questions. My question is, I have been trying, I'm growing some cabbage, broccoli, and Brussels sprouts, cabbage, Brussels sprouts. So it's the cabbage, cauliflower, and broccoli. that are being attacked by these green caterpillars that I just cannot get rid of, and I really don't want to use an insecticide. What would you recommend I try? And I tried a neem oil. That didn't work. So is there anything else that you would suggest?
Yeah, so those are cabbage loopers, which is just a fun name to say, cabbage looper. So they come from when you get the little white moth or the little white butterfly flying around your yard, those are the adults, and they love those cabbage leaves and broccoli leaves. So one thing you could do is maybe if you look online, you can find a growing net. You know, it's a real light, thin, almost transparent white net, and you could put those cabbage beneath that white net. They'd still get the sunlight, still get the moisture, especially if you're going to water them, and that might help protect them and minimize your looper invasion that you're running into.
Oh, cool. And what was the name of the net?
It's a real light shade cloth, and so it's almost transparent. But if you look online, like a Gimpler's catalog or Hummert's, you should be able to find it pretty easily.
All right. Thank you very much. You have a great weekend, sir. Right.
You too.
All right, Todd, you're on the Garden Hotline. Todd?
Hey, good morning, Chuck. Chuck, yes, good morning.
Good morning.
There's a great area down near, I'm sorry. What is it? Oxford? No. But anyway, I was looking for pine trees, tall pine trees, Chuck, and do they do well in clay soils?
So pine trees in general, so, you know, we plant a lot of white pines in St. Louis in our lousy soils, and as long as you've got that soil so it can dry out, you know, it doesn't like to be planted in a coffee cup. White pines would do well. Austrian and Scotch pines tend to be a little shorter lived here, 15 to 25 years, and they kind of wane out. The local or the native is a shortleaf pine, which isn't really a short needle at all, but it's a native, and it does pretty darn well in these crappy soils that we have.
All right, Jeff, you are the next caller on the Garden Hotline with Chuck.
So I've got a row of about 30-year-old boxwood that at the base of the stem, they have, like, developed this erosion. The bark exploded. They're browning out and dying. I've cut out the dead parts. I've treated it with antifungal, and I've treated it with some insecticide. Do you think I should just take those out, or can they come back around, or what?
Yeah, you know, I've got one boxwood that experienced that same thing in my house, and I'm trying to figure out what to do with it. It does, which doesn't normally happen with boxwoods. Generally, they're pretty bulletproof to stuff. So, yeah, I think anytime you can remove that diseased wood and remove it from the site, don't turn it into mulch. You know, don't compost it. Get it off your site in a way is going to be your best sanitary practice. I'll see if I can do a little research for you on that and maybe talk about that in an upcoming show about that boxwood issue. But I'm starting to see that a little bit more, which is surprising because that plant is just about bulletproof.
All right, Jeff, thanks for the call. We did pretty good on the lightning round there, Chuck. Did you want to mention briefly as we close cover crops?
Yeah, so remember, cover crops or companion plantings, companion crops, are a great way to keep the weeds out of your garden. Know that Mother Nature wants to put a green living plant every time she can in the soil. So if you're not doing it, then she's going to try to figure it out. And when she figures it out, it's normally a weed, right? We call that a weed. So if you mix, like, say, for example, beneath your tomato plants, could do peas or lettuce or spinach and allow them to cover and not worry necessarily so much about harvesting them as well as just letting them grow, that would be a great way to handle it.
The final words from Chuck Caverly, Garden Hotline. I'm Scott Jagow. Thanks for tuning in. We'll talk to you next week.
I'm Susie Welch, the host of Becoming You, a podcast where I help you stop living by default and start living by design. Listen to Becoming You wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Cardinals second baseman Nolan Gorman. It's game day.
It's the Cards and Rockies this afternoon. Amron Total Access 220. First pitch, 3:15.
Let's play ball.
On your voice of the Cardinals, KMOX.
It is the Garden Hotline on a Saturday morning, kind of a cloudy morning, June 8th. Chuck Caverly is here answering your questions. And we did an update last hour about Mike Miller. Tracy posted something on Facebook. I'm sorry, not Facebook. GoFundMe, the page, which is Mike's Epilepsy. If you are interested in getting that update and reading about his recovery and also possibly donating to help out with the situation there. But he is not walking right now, but trying to do whatever exercises he can. And if we get something else, we will pass it along to you. Okay, so Chuck is answering your questions now, and we have some phone calls. Let's go to Kelly. You're up next on the Garden Hotline.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I had a large tree taken down from my front yard in November, and there's nothing going on in my lawn. It's mostly weeds. There are a lot of dry, bald spots, and I'm just wondering what might work in that space, and when is the best time to start seeding?
So, you know, ideal time, my assumption would be that you'd want a cool grass lawn, which would be fescue, like turf-type tall fescues or bluegrass. So, Kelly, the ideal time of the year to do that is going to be late August, early September. Gives a chance for the plants, the new grass plants, to come up before you get into raking leaves, or in this case, raking your neighbor's leaves, perhaps. And so, the bare spots that you have now, you know, if you don't have a lawn program, if you didn't put down your pre-emergent herbicide this spring, you could go out in with a fork or a cultivator and cultivate those rough spots and or those brown spots, dry spots, and throw a little seed down, rake it over, and water it. But now you're going to be kind of hooked into watering, and we're going into the driest part of our season here in the next 4 to 8 weeks. So mm-hmm. I would tell you, as far as weed control goes, I'm a big believer in a 1 gallon pump up sprayer. You mix up 1 gallon of Weed Begone at a time. You go out and spray that 1 gallon, and then you rinse it out, put it back in the garage, and next week you might do it again. Otherwise, you know, you're going to drive yourself nuts trying to treat the whole thing all at one time. So, build on your successes and then get ready to really seed heavy in September. And I would do a double pass core aeration and then broadcast your seed after that.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much.
You bet. Glad you called this morning.
All right, up next, Donna, what is your question for Chuck Caverly?
Morning. I have an unusual situation. I recently purchased a red scarlet dogwood tree, and when it arrived in the mail, it was broken in half. It had been about 3 feet tall. It was a beautiful little tree, and I was heartbroken to see that broken like that. I kept the lower half, which is about 14 inches, and it is growing leaves at the top of the where I pruned it off, but yet the leaves are more of a chartreuse-like color. This tree was supposed to grow to about 20 to 25 feet. I'm just questioning, how much height do you think this tree will grow? Is it going to grow maybe half that amount of height, or what do you have to say about that?
So dogwoods are kind of what they call indiscriminate dominant. In other words, there's no main central leader. So horticulturally, when they're grown in the field, those nurserymen really work hard to create a classic tree, right? So in our mind's eye, we think of a single trunk with branches coming off of it on all sides. But mm-hmm. dogwoods, if you look at dogwoods that naturally exist, they might have 6 or 8 branches that go up to help make part of the canopy of the tree. So that little guy that got broken off, unfortunately, if you did a nice clean pruning job at the break and have got it established where it's growing, then I would sit back and make sure it's got plenty of mulch, keep a close eye on its water this year, let it get established. There's no reason why you can't expect it to get to 20 feet in height over time, but time is going to be probably 10 to 15 years before it gets that tall. Right. It would have been 12 to 15 years with the good guy before it got broken. So it will come on, and you've made it an investment in it. It came in the mail, and so I would give it a time to show you that it's capable of doing what you want it to do.
Sounds good. I have one other quick question. After that happened, I went and ordered another one. Another tree came, and this one is still in its little pot. And the grower, I contacted them to tell them that, I guess due to the heat we had, all the leaves on this little tree are like potato chips. They're real crunchy.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, she says, to put it in the ground and just keep it watered. She said the leaves should come back. Is that your take on it?
My take would be I would put it in the ground, I would get it watered in, I would maintain it, and then it will probably push a new set of leaves. Remember earlier I said plants are always planning for next year, and so in the case that those leaves all got burned off, it'll push a new set of growth, most likely, which means then as soon as it does that, it's going to start planning for next year. So I would keep the water on it all season long, you know, a good soaking once a week all through the summertime for the both of those dogwoods, and I think you'll be successful.
Okay. That's just what I wanted to hear. Okay. Thanks, Chuck. Have a great day.
Thank you, Donna. You too.
All right. Let's continue with the phone calls. Up next, Kay, you're on the Garden Hotline.
Thank you for answering all our questions. We appreciate this. I noticed that when I'm buying potted plants, flowers, the soil, it isn't soil. It feels like a sponge.
Exactly right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's what they call a soilless mix. So if you think about it, that grower wants to be able to control all of the conditions. And so if they start with a soilless mix that's sterile, they're not worried about any fungal pathogens or diseases or bacteria or any of that. That's the good news for them. And then they provide the nutrients that plant needs into that spongy, soilless mix, either granular or liquid as the plant grows. What needs to take place is once you get that out and when you go to plant it in your yard, you want to cultivate that soil right there where you're putting that plant in, and it would be helpful if you've got some compost to mix a little compost in every time you put that pot. I just spoke with my brother yesterday, and he was telling me about, well, Chuck, every time I put in a plant, I go to my compost bin, and I grab a scoopful of compost, and I mix it in with the soil and put it all back in. That's 100% accurate. That's the way to do it. So I would just encourage you to know that that's a real spongy. It's soilless. It allows for lots of plants to be produced very easily by the grower, and in theory, that should help keep the cost down for the rest of us.
Okay, what if I want to keep the it's a flowering plant.
Mm-hmm.
I want to keep it in that pot. Do I just have to water it a lot because it seems to dry out very fast?
Yeah, so you might try putting a saucer on the bottom and then watering the saucer and allow the moisture to come up into the plant as opposed from the top down. And then that way, if you got a little granular, a little time release, I don't think Miracle-Gro makes a time release, but there's some granular fertilizers out there by Fertilome and a couple of other producers that you could get at your local garden center. That's a time release, like a 3 to 4 month or an 8 to 9 month. So you don't have to go out with Miracle-Gro and put it down every 2 weeks, right? You just do it one time, and that'll feed that plant for the whole season.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Kay. Have a great day.
Same to you.
Thanks for your call. It is 314-436-7900, the Garden Hotline on KMOX. Chuck Caverly taking your questions. Stay tuned. We'll have more of them just ahead.
This is the St. Louis Composting Garden Hotline with Mike Miller on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Just a few minutes left on this Saturday morning with Chuck Caverly answering your questions. So our challenge now is to get through as many questions as we can in the next 5 minutes. Let's go. Larry, you're up first.
Hey, good morning, Chuck. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I've got a question. I have a tree line behind my home that separates me from my neighbor's property, and I would just like to introduce some understory shrubs and bushes into that, and I'm wondering what would do well in the shade of those trees. It really doesn't get much sun there at all.
So just three quick suggestions for you. Anything in the viburnum group would do fantastic for you in that kind of partial sun, partial shade, or heavy shade would do well. Annabelle hydrangeas or the straight hydrangea arborescens would do well back there. And then the third choice for you might be a spice bush, which is a little bit different kind of shrub, but it's got a burgundy flower. I have some at my house. I planted them 3 years ago out of a 5-gallon pot, and I think they're probably 8 feet tall now, hold their leaves late. So they're your three quick suggestions.
Great. Thank you very much, Chuck. I hope you have a great day.
Same to you, sir.
Thanks, Larry. Chris, you're up next on the Garden Hotline.
Well, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. First, I want to say thanks for the update on Mike Miller. We'll keep him in our prayers, and I'm sure he's proud of the job you're doing. You're doing a great job answering questions. My question is, I have been trying, I'm growing some cabbage, broccoli, and Brussels sprouts. No, it's the cabbage, cauliflower, and broccoli that are being attacked by these green caterpillars that I just cannot get rid of, and I really don't want to use an insecticide. What would you recommend I try? And I tried a Neem oil. That didn't work. So is there anything else that you would suggest?
Yeah, so those are cabbage loopers, which is just a fun name to say, cabbage looper. So they come from when you get the little white moth or the little white butterfly flying around your yard, those are the adults. And they love those cabbage leaves and broccoli leaves. So one thing you could do is maybe if you look online, you can find a growing net. You know, it's a real light, thin, almost transparent white net. And you could put those cabbage beneath that white net. They'd still get the sunlight, still get the moisture, especially if you're going to water them. And that might help protect them and minimize your looper invasion that you're running into.
Oh, cool. And what was the name of the net?
It's a real light shade cloth, and so it's almost transparent. But if you look online, like a Gimpler's catalog or Hummert's, you should be able to find it pretty easily.
All right, thank you very much. You have a great weekend, sir. Right.
You too.
All right, Todd, you're on the Garden Hotline. Todd,
hey, good morning, Chuck. Chuck, yes, good morning.
Good morning.
There's a great area down near. I'm sorry. What is it? Longford? No. But anyway, I was looking for pine trees, tall pine trees, Chuck, and do they do well in clay soils?
So pine trees in general, so, you know, we plant a lot of white pines in St. Louis in our lousy soils. And as long as you've got that soil so it can dry out, you know, it doesn't like to be planted in a coffee cup. White pines would do well. Austrian and Scotch pines tend to be a little shorter lived here, 15 to 25 years, and they kind of wane out. The local or the native is a shortleaf pine, which isn't really a short needle at all, but it's a native, and it does pretty darn well in these crappy soils that we have.
All right, Jeff, you are the next caller on the Garden Hotline with Chuck.
So I've got a row of about 30-year-old boxwood that at the base of the stem, they have, like, developed this erosion. The bark exploded, and they're browning out and dying. I've cut out the dead parts. I've treated it with antifungal, and I've treated it with some insecticide. Do you think I should just take those out, or can they come back around, or what?
Yeah. You know, I've got one boxwood that experienced that same thing in my house, and I'm trying to figure out what to do with it. It does, which doesn't normally happen with boxwoods. Generally, they're pretty bulletproof to stuff. So, yeah, I think anytime you can remove that diseased wood and remove it from the site, don't turn it into mulch. You know, don't compost it. Get it off your site in a way is going to be your best sanitary practice. I'll see if I can do a little research for you on that and maybe talk about that in an upcoming show about that boxwood issue. But I'm starting to see that a little bit more, which is surprising because that plant is just about bulletproof.
All right, Jeff, thanks for the call. We did pretty good on the lightning round there, Chuck. Did you want to mention briefly as we close cover crops?
Yeah, so remember, cover crops or companion plantings, companion crops, are a great way to keep the weeds out of your garden. Know that Mother Nature wants to put a green living plant every time she can in the soil. So if you're not doing it, then she's going to try to figure it out. And when she figures it out, it's normally a weed, right? We call that a weed. So if you mix, like, say, for example, beneath your tomato plants, could do peas or lettuce or spinach and allow them to cover and not worry necessarily so much about harvesting them as well as just letting them grow, that would be a great way to handle it.
The final words from Chuck Caverly, Garden Hotline. I'm Scott Jagow. Thanks for tuning in. We'll talk to you next week.
The Second World War is the largest event in human history.
A 20-part series with Tom Hanks.
No part of the globe was untouched. No life unchanged.
Experience the ultimate account of World War II.
Every single person had a story. These are the stories that make us who we are.
Listen to World War II with Tom Hanks on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.